Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is a real privilege. I'm inviting, as I described in my blog post, somebody to the Salieri Report who I believe fits the description of a great accountant. And as you know, it's hard to find, and if you do, treasure them forever. Patty Kemmerer is a member of Kemmerer Schooley Smith, CPAs in Northern Virginia. She has a wealth of experience working with both businesses, individuals, not-for-profits. I first met her when I was at Hamilton Securities, so I can tell you she also has a lot of experience dealing with all the complexities of government and government contractors and the issues that they deal with. She's a member of many accounting societies, but one of the things I most appreciate about Patty is she's very experienced, very grounded, very practical, and yet can deal with all the complexity that is involved when you deal with all these different kinds of issues. And so I asked Patty to join us to discuss for those who file U.S. taxes, both individual and small business issues that are the most important to focus on in 2013. We're coming into 2014, so what are the actions we can take before the end of the year or need to take at the beginning of the year to make sure we're on top of our taxes? So, Patty, it's holiday season. Thank you for taking time out of what I know is a very busy schedule to join us on the Salieri Report.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Well, top of our list, of course, is the Affordable Health Care Act, which I must tell you, we had a rule in Washington, which was, you know, never do something too complicated that the average person is going to have to deal with. Of course, every time I try and understand the Affordable Health Care Act, I think, uh-oh, they broke the rule. So take us through the Affordable Health Care Act. We're now in a period when it applies. So what does it mean to our taxes? What do we need to know about the Affordable Health Care Act?
Well, as you know, all individuals that are required to have that minimum essential coverage by March 31st, 2014, or they have to be exempt in order to avoid the shared responsibility payment, which is being commonly addressed as the penalty for not having it, the coverage
right.
by March 14th. And the shared responsibility payment and the Act itself is effective January 1st, 2014. It applies to all individuals of all ages, including children. So adults or a married couple who claim an individual as a dependent is responsible to make the payment for the dependent who doesn't have coverage. So parents need to be aware that it's not just them, it's also their children that have to be covered, or they have to pay the shared responsibility payment penalty with their tax return when they file their 2014 taxes in 2015. There are some exemptions for people to be excluded from this. And just to go over a few of the more common ones, if a person does not have a filing requirement, they are not required to pay the shared responsibility payment. That would be someone whose income is below the minimum threshold for filing a tax return. So if you don't have to file a tax return because you're below that threshold, you're not required to pay the shared responsibility payment if you don't have coverage. Also, if you have a short coverage gap, being without coverage for less than 3 consecutive months during the year, then you also don't have to pay the penalty. If there's a hardship, the health insurance marketplace has determined conclusively that a person has a hardship that makes them unable to obtain coverage, they're also excluded from paying the penalty. In addition, if a person is not lawfully present in the United States, they are also exempt from paying the penalty.
Is lawfully present, do you know what the time period is on that?
I do not know what the time period is. I presume
okay.
that it's during the calendar year. or at the end of the calendar year, if you're not lawfully
right.
present, you know, you're still required to file tax returns in theory,
right.
but because you would probably meet the substantial presence test. That is, if you're in the country, even on, illegally, for more than 183 days of the year and you earn money here, you're supposed to file a tax return. But if you're here unlawfully, you're not required to pay this penalty if you don't have health insurance coverage
right.
by the deadline. Right. Also, just to let people know, the shared responsibility payment penalty is the greater of 1% of yearly household income, or $95 per person, $47.50 for a child under 18 for 2014. And the maximum household penalty for 2014 is $285. So you hear many people talking about, well, they'll just pay the penalty. It's a fairly low penalty in 2014, but it will go up to 2% of income and $325 per person in 2015. And 2.5% of income, or $695 per person for 2016. After that, it will be adjusted for inflation. So while it's fairly low penalty in 2014, as you can see, it will go up and will become more substantial as time goes on.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting because I know people who, you know, they live with family, and so the household income is defined in a way that catches a lot of income which is not available to them. And I've literally had people tell me they're thinking of getting divorced just because they can't afford to pay the penalty.
I've heard that as well.
Right.
But, you know, household income is household income, so getting
right.
divorced, if you're still going to live together, I'm not sure that that will avoid the issue.
Okay.
So that would be very sad.
Penalties are sad. Okay. So now when the White House has delayed the application to small business or to business for a year, is that correct?
That is correct. That just recently came about.
But they, you know, the debate when there was the squabble at the beginning or, you know, recently was over whether or not they would delay individuals, and they haven't. This still applies.
This does still apply. This
okay.
has not been delayed for individuals.
Okay. Okay. So let's keep going on the healthcare issues.
Okay. Also, there is a premium tax credit that is available for lower income individuals that can assist with lowering the premiums. They have to buy the health insurance through the marketplace. They have to be ineligible for coverage through an employer or a government plan. They have to be, like I said, within these lower income limits. If they're married, they have to file a joint return, and they cannot be a dependent on another person. So if a person is eligible for this premium tax credit, they have two choices of what to do with it. They can take sort of an advance on it now and have the credit paid directly to the insurance company to lower their out-of-pocket cost on a monthly basis, or can get it later when they file their tax return.
Okay.
So those are two choices for the premium credit. Also, as you know, there were some surprises in the tax, in this law, related to an additional Medicare tax of 0.9% for taxpayers who have earnings over applicable thresholds in 2014.
Now, that's $200,000 on earned income, or it includes investment income?
It's on earnings of $200,000 or more for a single filer, or $250,000 for married filing joint. And that is joint income. So a married couple is much more likely to reach the threshold faster than perhaps a single individual would be.
Right.
Now, once a person reaches $200,000 in earned income, their employer is supposed to withhold the additional 0.9% of tax that they're required to pay. And this is only a tax on the employee. The employer does not have to match that 0.9% for that for those wages above $200,000, like they do for the other wages that they pay the Medicare tax matching on.
Right.
The 2.9% Medicare tax. It's 1.5%, 1.45% for the individual earner and 1.45% for the employer. The employer continues just to pay the 1.45%. They don't have to pay the additional 0.9. If the employer
right.
doesn't withhold it, ultimately the employee is going to be liable to pay it with their tax return. And in theory, the employer could be fined for not withholding it when they're
okay.
supposed to.
Okay. Now the investment tax is on top of this one.
Right. It's 3.8%. It applies to taxpayers who have earnings above those same thresholds, $200,000 for a single filer and $250,000 for married filing joint return.
Now, okay, so let me get this. If I have, let's say I have $200,000 of earned income. I have $100,000 of capital gains and $100,000 of dividend and interest income in a given year.
Right.
Is the 3.8 is on the dividend and interest. It's going to be across the board since I already have $200,000 of earned income.
Correct.
And is it going to be 3.8 on capital gains as well?
It will. It's going to be on base, it's going to be on income from interest, dividends, annuities, royalties, and rents. So
on
people
rent
with
well.
Rent, yes,
right.
on rent as well. It's also going to be on income that passes through from a trade or business if the person is passive in that business. That is to say, they're simply an investor in a small business or in a REIT or whatever they're invested in, and they're not an active participant in the day-to-day activities, they're considered to be a passive investor. It's an investment for them, not a business. And so those funds coming through from K-1s, from partnerships and S-corporations, would also be hit with this 3.8%.
So if you're above $200,000, basically your capital gains rates change to 18.8%.
Well, yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
It's actually could be higher than that if you're up in the 20%
right.
capital gains rate, and
right.
you add this on top of it, so it becomes 23.8%. Also, things that one thing that a lot of people probably are not aware of, that if someone is selling their principal residence and they have more than $250,000 in gain if they're single, or $500,000 in gain if they're married filing joint, the amount above those two thresholds is taxable for capital gains tax and will be subject to this 3.8% if they're over the earned income thresholds.
Even if it's their primary residence.
Even if it's their primary residence.
Wow, so that's a very significant hit.
Yes, it
yes.
could be.
Yes, could be. Okay.
Now,
sobering.
the type of income that is excluded from the 3.8% net investment income tax are things like non-taxable income, municipal bond interest, for example,
okay.
would not be included for this. Social Security benefits and alimony are excluded. Retirement plan distributions are excluded. And
okay.
any income that's subject to self-employment Medicare tax would be excluded. For example, a self-employed person with a Schedule C.
Okay. Well, let's turn to health. I call them health savings accounts. So one of the let's walk through sort of what the new limit is, but also I'd be very interested to hear if you think what's happening is going to make sort of increase interest in health savings accounts.
Right. There is a new limit on the health savings account of $2,500 is the most that an employee can request for a salary reduction as a contribution to the flexible spending arrangement. Are we talking the health savings, the HSA?
Right.
Okay, so the HSA.
Is health flexible spending arrangements the same thing as an HSA?
It is not. It is.
It's not. Okay, sorry.
That's okay. The flexible spending arrangement is a deduction from taxable income right off the top. They can have their employer withhold certain amounts that can then be spent later for health purposes, for medical reasons, daycare and the like. So that's a flexible spending arrangement. It's also called a Section 125 plan,
okay,
where people can put the money aside for use later. The limit on that is now $2,500 that can be requested to be set aside from a paycheck to pay for future medical expenses.
And can't that be used to pay for your health care plan or insurance?
It can.
It can, right.
It can, yes. But you wanted to talk HSAs?
If you're ready to. Solari keeps playing with starting an HSA, so.
Yeah. Yes, for HSA, you can deduct the contributions that you make to the account. And the earnings on those are tax deferred until they're withdrawn, much like an IRA.
Right.
If they're withdrawn for medical purposes, they are withdrawn tax free.
So if the employee takes the money out of the HSA to use it to buy health care insurance, at that point, it's not taxable to the employee, so it's tax free.
Well, you have to have a high deductible health plan in place,
okay,
for the HSA to have an HSA.
Okay.
And you can't be enrolled in Medicare.
Okay.
So in 2013 and 2014, the minimum deductible for a high deductible health plan has to be at least $1,250 for a single coverage,
okay,
and $2,500 for a family coverage.
Okay.
Now, if funds are not used for medical purposes, once you turn 65, you can withdraw the money out to use for any purpose, and it's taxed just like an IRA.
Okay, but there's no penalty for withdrawal.
Right.
Okay.
After age 65.
Okay, so... So tell us, what can we do to what are the steps now? It's we're going to play this on December 5th. What can we do now before the end of the year to ease our tax burden for 13 and 14?
Well, before we jump there, let me just back up one second, if you don't mind, and
please,
just mention that the Schedule A deduction, or the Schedule A medical deduction, now has to exceed 10% of your adjusted gross income. It has been 7.5%. This was part of the Affordable Care Act as well.
Okay.
That threshold is now increased to 10%. So your medical expenses have to exceed 10% of your adjusted gross income in order for you to take any deduction for medical expenses. For people who are 65 and older, the 7.5% remains in place through 2016. But if you're under 65, it has jumped, actually for 2013, it has jumped to 10%.
Okay.
So just so people are aware of that as well. Now, back to your question, which was, what can we do at this point in time? If someone thinks that if they're not at that $200,000, $250,000 threshold yet in 2013 to trigger this 0.9% and the 3.8% additional taxes, but they feel like maybe in 2014 they might push over those limits, one thing that they might be able to do is pull some of those earnings for 2014, if possible, into 2013 to try to avoid triggering those two additional
taxes. So,
for
example, if you have gains, you can take them.
Exactly. If you have gains, you can take them. You know, if you think it's going to push you over for 2014, but you can take some of them in 2013 and still not push over the limit and perhaps stay under the limit for 2014 as well, that's one thing that would be a good idea to take a look at.
Okay.
Also, there are things that you can do to accelerate deductions into 2013 if you feel like you're getting close to that limit in 2013 and you want to reduce your income. You can pay your fourth quarter state estimated tax installments in December instead of January because you can get the deduction for them in 2013 if you just pay them a couple of weeks early in December.
Right.
You could pay your entire property tax bill, including installments due in 2014 by the end of the year, and also pull that into your deductions for 2013.
Okay.
You can try to bunch your threshold expenses. When I say threshold expenses, I mean things like medical expenses that have to exceed that 10% threshold. And there's also miscellaneous itemized deductions that have to exceed 2% of your adjusted gross income before you can take any deduction. And those would be things like investment expenses, job hunting expenses, home office deductions for persons who are employees of a company but who work at home for the convenience of their employer. Things like anything that you can pull into 2013 to help reduce the 2013 income. Also, you could pay 2014 tuition for if you have a college student. You could pay the 2014 tuition in 2013 and perhaps get a deduction or credit for that. In addition, there are some non-business energy credits that you might be able to take for 2013. The credit is 10% of the cost of certain energy-saving property that you add to your main home. It includes qualified insulation, windows, doors, roofs, and biomass stoves. It has to be on your main home, the existing main home in the United States. A newly constructed home or a rental does not qualify for these credits. There's a maximum lifetime limit of $500 on the credits. And when I say it's a credit, I mean it's a dollar-for-dollar credit. That means for each dollar of credit, you reduce $1 of tax liability for these particular
credits. So if I spend
credits.
$500 on tighter doors that qualify,
yes, you
then
get
I get
10%.
A 500. Oh, I get 10%.
You get 10%.
So
yes.
I get $50.
Right, and that would be a $50 reduction in your tax bill.
Now, those are extended through 2013. Will they apply in 2014?
I believe that one is going away, actually, for 2014.
So it's use it or lose it.
You're kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
And when I said, and you can't just contract for these items if you're going to get new windows installed, for example. The windows have to be installed by December 31st.
Okay. So the home improvement guys are going to be very busy before the end of the year.
Yeah, I think so. So, you know, if you want to get new windows, probably now is the time to call. By the way, speaking of windows, only $200 of the $500 can go towards windows. That's the maximum for window credit.
If you look at how expensive windows are, I'm not sure it's going to go far, but...
I agree. But, you know, every little bit
every
helps.
Little bit counts, yes.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's talk about gifting.
Okay. Well, one of the things you can do is do some charitable gifting. You know, there's been a law over the last few years, which also is going to expire at the end of this year, where you can transfer directly up to $100,000 from your IRA to a charitable organization and get a deduction for it.
That oh, my.
That is expiring.
Okay.
At the end of this year. That has been in place for several years.
Okay.
But this is the last year to do that. Also,
so if,
for those
and,
of us...
And so someone could, for example, if they wanted to donate to their church, they could shift $10,000 out of an IRA to the church and then take a $10,000 deduction on their taxes.
Schedule A, right. They do have to claim the $10,000 distribution as well, so it's kind of a wash, but at least you don't have to pay the tax on the distribution.
Okay, so basically what it does is it covers the deduction offsets the tax you'd have to pay on the distribution.
That's correct.
Okay.
Now, you can donate cash as well as property to a qualified charity. And generally, when you donate property, you can claim the fair market value of that property as a deduction. Contributions of appreciated property, like stock, for example, provide an additional benefit in that if you donate appreciated stock to a charity, you can write off the value of that stock and avoid paying capital gains tax.
Right.
So that's an added benefit of donating appreciated investment property. You can also donate services to charity, of course, but the value of your service to the charity is not deductible. Only your out-of-pocket expenses are. And I've seen this quite a bit over my more than 25 years of experience in this area. Small business people donate services, graphic design, whatever they're doing to a charity, and they want to write off the value of that, what they would have charged a customer to perform those services. And unfortunately, you're not allowed to do that.
Okay.
So only your out-of-pocket costs are deductible. That would include some charity-related travel expenses and some other out-of-pocket expenses. You must have a written record to take a deduction. It doesn't necessarily, if it's under $250, you don't absolutely have to have a receipt from the charity if you can show some other way that you made the donation, for example, a canceled check.
Okay.
If we've made
a donation of $250 to 501c3, do we need to get a letter back saying, you know, that we've made this donation and it does not include, you know, payment for goods or services?
Yes.
So we need a letter. Okay.
Yeah, some kind of a receipt, a letter.
Okay. And, okay. So keep going.
Okay. So that's a current deduction on your current year taxes for charitable donations. Now, another thing we probably need to touch on, which is not a current year deduction, but something people do need to think about, is giving year-end giving to reduce potential estate tax in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Federal gift and estate tax exemptions are currently set at $5.25 million. So that means the first 5.25 million of a value of a person's estate is exempt from tax under current law. That's going to increase to 5.34 million in 2014. Also, the maximum estate tax is now capped at 40%. People can give gifts to other people of up to $14,000 per year without having to file a gift tax return. And most people don't realize also that the gift tax return is filed by the person who gives the gift, not the person who receives the gift. So that's something to keep in mind. A couple can give a joint gift to a third person of up to $28,000. That would be $14,000 coming from each of them to the third person. They do, of course, have to agree to the gift in order to take the exemption of up to $28,000 for a gift to a third person. So that's one way people gift, especially around holiday time, gift right. to their relatives and friends to be generous, of course, to these folks, but also to try to reduce the value of their estate for future estate tax planning purposes.
Okay.
And then, of course, gift tax return is due if you do give a gift that exceeds the $14,000, you do have to file a gift tax return, and it's due on the same date as your regular tax return.
Okay. Okay. Okay, retirement plan contributions. This one is a big one for our subscribers because I think up there, you know, there's a tremendous amount of concern that the provisions will change over time. So there's always interest in, for example, in should I move to a Roth? So tell us about retirement plan contributions for 2013.
Right. If you own a business, you should consider setting up a retirement plan if you don't already have one. You can set up the plan by the end of the year, or even you can set up a SEP plan, a Simplified Employee Pension Plan, even early next year. Make the contribution by the due date of your tax return, including extensions. So potentially you could push it all the way to October 15th of 2014 and get the deduction on your 2013 tax return. So that's a really good way to help reduce your tax liability and set some money aside for yourself for the future. If you don't plan for your retirement, nobody else will.
Right. Now Roth conversions. It's still possible to convert from a simple IRA to a Roth?
It is. You do have to pay the tax on it at the time of conversion, but then that money is considered after-tax dollars in the Roth, so when you draw it out later, you won't pay tax on it later.
Right. So your fear is if your taxes are going to increase or the rates are going to increase in the future, that's the benefit of accelerating the tax into this year.
Exactly.
Right.
So if you are an employee and your employer has a 401k plan, if at all possible, you should try to maximize your contributions to that for 2013. Time's running out, so you would have to put in a big chunk at this point, perhaps, to get to the maximum contribution, which is $17,500 for a person under the age of 50. And if you're over 50, you could add a $5,500 catch-up contribution as well.
Okay.
If there are no retirement plans, if you're an employee, you don't have, your employer doesn't offer one, you can make a deductible contribution of up to $5,500 to a traditional IRA and deduct it. If you are under 50 and an additional $1,000 or $6,500 total if you're 50 or over.
Okay. Okay, and more on SHA? Did we want to mention that?
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, I think we pretty much covered that earlier.
Okay.
You can deduct those contributions to the account. So if you need some more deductions this year, you may want to consider an HSA. You do have to make the contribution to it this year, and you have to have that high deductible health plan in place.
Now, can an individual start an HSA, or do you need an employer?
You do not need an employer. An individual.
So an individual can do it. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Section 179.
Section 179. In 2013, a business can elect to expense the entire cost of most new equipment, up to $500,000, for the first $2 million of property placed in service by December 31. So it's much like the windows and doors, it has to be in place by December 31st.
Now, so does this apply for all computer and
equipment
and office equipment?
It sure does.
Wow.
Yes.
So you can write off 100%.
100% of it, up to $500,000.
Okay.
Now, that provision was expanded after 9/11 to try to stimulate the economy. That provision is, the expanded provision is expiring at the end of this year. In 2014, that deduction limit is reduced from $500,000 down to $25,000 on the first $200,000 of equipment purchased. So you can see there's a precipitous drop after 2013. So
right.
If any of your listeners were considering investing in large equipment, they may want to pull that into 2013 and go ahead and buy it now rather than waiting till January or February to do it.
Okay.
Now, qualified, it has to be qualified property, and qualified property is placed in service during the tax year and used predominantly in your trade or business. That means it has to be more than 50% business use. We see this, you know, with business equipment such as computers and office equipment, generally that's 100% business use. The real issue is generally vehicles. Vehicles are not always 100% business use, and so you have to make sure that if it's more than 50%, in order to take any kind of a Section 179 deduction on a vehicle. Also, vehicles have real stringent limits on Section 179 deductions, Section 179 deductions. And you want to discuss that with your tax preparer. SUVs get a higher deduction than luxury autos. Luxury
mm-hmm.
autos are autos that generally exceed $15,300 in cost. So that's pretty much just about any vehicle that you
right.
would want to buy.
Okay.
So that is one thing to talk to your tax preparer about if you're thinking about buying new vehicles before the end of the year, because you're not going to get as much bang for your buck on a vehicle necessarily as you would other business equipment.
Okay. Okay, so CAP, let's see, how to increase basis in S-Corp. A lot of subscribers do have S-Corp, so this is of great interest.
Yeah, a lot of people, it's very hard for most business owners to get their head wrapped around what their basis in their S-Corporation really is. Their basis is basically what their investment in their corporation. And if the corporation has losses, that reduces their basis. You can only deduct losses up to the amount of your basis, and that's something that your tax professional should be keeping track of on a year-to-year basis to determine what that number is. If your losses exceed your basis, you can't deduct that the total amount of that loss currently, unless you do something to increase your basis. If you have a loss in your business, most likely your business could use some cash. So you could either loan money to your company or make a capital contribution to your company. Either one of those things will increase your basis in the company so that you can deduct more of the current year loss. Of course, the risk is that putting more money into your company makes more of your personal funds at risk. And you need to really consider before doing that whether or not the fact that your company has a loss this year is indicative of trouble ahead.
Right.
If you feel like there is, you know, choppy waters ahead for your company, you may not want to put more money into it at the risk of losing the additional funds as well. So you do need to sit with your advisor and discuss whether or not this makes good fiscal sense for you, not just from a tax perspective, but from a long-term investment perspective.
So now, if you can't write off the losses this year, can you roll them over? So
you
they
can
carry
them. You can carry them over.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You certainly can. So they're not. They don't disappear. They just get deferred to a year when you have a profit to take the losses against.
Okay. Okay. And okay, so let's now go over expiring provisions. You said that there are 52 provisions set to expire. We're not going to go through all 52.
No, not at all. Let's just kind of hit the highlights. So, as you may recall, people who have had trouble in this economy with making their mortgage payments were allowed an exclusion for a discharge of their qualified principal residence indebtedness of up to $2 million if they lost their home, for example.
So let me explain what that means. What that means is if you lost your home or you were in a foreclosure and your mortgage was written off, that
right.
normally would have been a write-off of indebtedness becomes a taxable event, and that's income to you. And so what we're saying is up to $2 million, that was, you basically had a get-out-of-jail-free card on that. That got relieved. So what we're saying is that when traditionally, if I had a mortgage on a home, and this applied to other indebtedness, not just mortgages, but let's say we're just talking about a home, and the home was foreclosed on and the mortgage written off, that would be a taxable event. That would be considered income to me, that the debt was written off. And what was provided by the federal government was relief for a certain period so that when that debt was written off, it wasn't considered a taxable event. And I didn't have to pay tax on a write down of indebtedness. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yes.
Okay.
Forgiveness of debt has normally been a taxable event, but this law did exclude people who were in this situation as long as the debt was qualified principal residence debt. That is to say that it had to be your principal residence, and it had to be debt that you used to purchase or improve your home. Some people have gotten caught with home equity debt that was not considered qualified principal residence debt. But in any case, that provision expires at the end of this year.
Okay,
so is no longer going to be available.
Okay. Well, I don't see how anybody can accelerate that into 2013. If you need that, if you're in that situation, that's an unbelievably important thing to have.
But the other thing is there's also been a provision that will still exist that if you are insolvent at the time of the debt discharge, then you also don't have to pay tax on it. So, as we go into 2014, if someone finds themselves in this situation and can show that they were insolvent at the time of the discharge of the debt, they still will not have to pay tax on the income from that discharge of debt.
Okay. Now go ahead.
Go ahead. I was just going to say I was going to touch on a couple of others. One is the $250 deduction for expenses of school teachers. That's been around for several years now, and you know, school teachers are always dipping into their pockets to pay for things for their classrooms that the school system doesn't cover for them, and they've been allowed to claim up to $250 deduction for that on the front of their tax returns. That's another expiring provision.
Just
those
seems...
expenses will now go on to Schedule A as a miscellaneous itemized deduction subject to 2% of your adjusted gross income as unreimbursed employee business expense.
Okay. Okay, were there any others you wanted to mention?
The deduction for qualified higher education expenses is going to go away. The credit will still be there. There was an option where you could deduct the expenses on the front of your return or take a credit on page 2. The deduction piece for the front of the return is expiring.
Okay.
So that will no longer be there.
Okay, and people can find a list of those on the IRS website?
It is not. It is actually it's www.jct.gov is where
okay.
you can go to look for that.
Okay, now.
And there's a whole list of them.
To deal with this complexity, the filing season for 2014 has been delayed?
It has been delayed, and what that means is the IRS will not be able to process tax returns for 2013 at the date that they had originally anticipated, which was January 21st, was when they were going to start processing. Because of the government shutdown in October of 16 days, which was their prime time for testing their systems and updating their software, they're going to have to postpone the date when they will start processing returns by up to 2 weeks. They will not be able to start processing any earlier than January 28th, and it could be as late as February 4th. They're supposed to come out this month with a definite date of when they will start processing, but they have not yet made that announcement.
So what we're saying is our filing deadlines haven't changed, but their ability to generate a refund is slowed down.
Yes, exactly. A lot of people like to file their tax returns immediately in January so that they can get their refunds, obviously. But the processing date has been pushed back, so you won't be able to get your refund as early in the year as you normally would.
Okay, well, there were a couple of what I called red flags that I also wanted to touch on. A lot of our subscribers have foreign accounts, and because of that, file FBAR reforms or what's called PIFIC filings. And the one thing I just wanted to underscore is if you have foreign accounts, it's absolutely imperative that they be fully disclosed. And if you're subject to an FBAR or any of these other forms, that you do it. Because, you know, what I find is foreign accounts, not properly disclosing your foreign accounts can really cause some, trouble. So in terms of keeping records or making sure you or your CPA file those forms, you want to make sure you do it. So
right, and those forms are due by June 30th of the year, by the way.
Right, the FBAR. But there's now in the regular filings, there's disclosure as well. So
that's correct.
Right.
At the bottom of Schedule B, you have to state whether or not you have any interest in foreign bank accounts.
Now, the other thing was, I know we mentioned charitable deductions, but to me, this is another red flag, is making sure you have proper documentation for all your deductions, because I do think it's an area that has increased focus. Are there any others, Patty, that you think are important?
As far as red flags?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I can tell you this, that if, depending on your income, will the amount of your income may be more likely to trigger an audit. For example, people under $200,000 of income on their tax return, their audit chances are about 1.03%. People with incomes of over $200,000 have an audit rate of approximately 3.7%, or one out of every 27 returns are audited. And people who report more than $1 million in income have a 1 in 8 chance of being audited, just because of the level of income that you're reporting.
Right.
You also have to be very careful to report everything that you receive a 1099 for, because the IRS receives copies of all W-2s and 1099s, and they do have an automated matching program. So if you haven't reported something on your return that was reported to the IRS, you're much more likely to get audited on your return.
Now, let's say I file my taxes and then realize that I forgot to report something. I can always amend, right?
That's correct. You can file a Form 1040X form to report that additional income and pay the tax on it. The IRS has up to 3 years to audit you, so sometimes people don't hear from the IRS for 3 years after they file the return and can't remember what they did or didn't do at that point in time, or
right,
where their papers got off to. You know, so make sure that you keep your support for all your tax deductions and income for a minimum of 3 years.
And what would you say would be advisable? 5 years?
Generally, I'd say 5 to 7 years.
Okay.
If the IRS suspects fraud, if you've missed a big income item, if you've missed reporting it, and the IRS suspects that, suspects fraud, there is no limit.
Right.
They can come back to you without limit. So I generally tell people to keep things for at least 7 years.
Okay. Well, there are two sort of drumbeats I constantly hammer on with subscribers and with clients, and that is, if you want to be impeccable about records, you want to keep a record of everything. And the other prejudice I have, which please don't do your taxes yourself. If there's any way you can get an accountant, a good accountant, to do them, I think it's really, we're now talking about a level of complexity that is extraordinary. And unless you are very good at this kind of stuff and really want to take the time, I think you just need somebody who's in the thin and thick of it. So since I'm not the CPA here, I'll bang that drum. And I think it's very important that you tell them you keep good records and you tell them everything. You're fully disclosed. And then if a mistake happens, mistakes happen in complex systems. But I think then if you've made best efforts to be fully compliant, you don't run into trouble. I'm continually amazed running into clients who continue to, or subscribers who continue to think that there's such a thing as privacy in this financial system. And although I would say that the Mr. Snowden has done a lot to persuade everyone that that privacy is not what they thought it was. So I just think it's very, very important to be as impeccable as possible. And if you are, then you sleep at night. I think it's a great investment to be impeccable on all this stuff, and then you don't have to worry.
Absolutely. I agree 100%.
Okay. One other thing you mentioned, which I just wanted to touch on, was telephone scams, because I hear more and more reports of this. Hasn't happened to me personally, and I just thought maybe we should say a few things about it, because if you look at what's going on in the internet or phones, the scamsters are clearly out.
They are, and they're very sophisticated as well.
Yeah.
They know more about you than you really think that they do. And what they're doing is it's a telephone scam. They call you and they say that you owe money to the IRS and that it must be paid promptly, either through a preloaded debit card or a wire transfer. And if the victim refuses to cooperate, they threaten them with arrest, deportation, or suspension of a business or driver's license. One thing, some things you need to know is that the IRS never asks for credit card numbers over the phone. It never requests prepaid debit cards or wire transfers. They don't ask for PINs, passwords, or any other similar confidential access information for credit card, bank, or other financial account. And generally, the first contact with a taxpayer on an IRS tax issue is most likely to occur via regular snail mail, not email. There are a lot of emails also that are coming out that appear to be from the IRS. Do not open any attachments if you receive an email from the IRS that appears to be from the IRS. And you can forward the email if you get it to phishing@irs.gov, and that is phishing@irs.gov. So if you receive an email, please send it there. Now back to the telephone scam.
Uh-huh.
They use fake names and IRS badge numbers, so they sound very official. They may be able to recite the last four digits of your social. So generally, you're going to think, oh, my, they must be really legitimate. They know my social. Not true. They may know it, but they're still not legit. They can actually spoof the IRS toll-free number on your caller ID to make it appear that the IRS is the one that's calling. And after they call you, they may follow up with an email.
Right. One of the things I've discovered, because I had to do this a lot, sort of over the last 15 years, if you hang up and call the IRS, the IRS, in my experience, has very excellent customer service. Now, on a busy day, it may take a while to get through, but you can usually get through, and you can get through to somebody who's competent and can handle your request. And so, if you have any doubts, you can always hang up and just call the IRS.
Right. So if you get one of the calls and you know you owe taxes or you think you might, you should call their 800 number, which is 800-829-1040.
Okay.
On the other hand, if they call and you know you don't owe any tax, they recommend that you call the Treasury Inspector General.
Okay.
At 800-366-4484. And they also advise that you should contact the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, and use their FTC complaint assistant at ftc.gov and add the words IRS telephone scam to your comments in the complaint.
Okay, now there's one more thing I wanted to go over, Patty. Don't laugh. This is important. When you send your taxes in, explain to us in snail mail what we should do. Should we have it registered, certified receipt? Should we just dump it in the mail? I want to make sure when we mail it that we have the proper proof that we sent it off.
Right. You can always have a certified receipt. You don't necessarily need to send the green card, which is the card that they stamp it and send it back, unless that makes you feel more comfortable. But you do need proof of mailing. The filing date of April 15th, for example, if you mail your return on April 15th, it is considered timely filed. It doesn't have to be in their hands on April 15th. But if you're going to wait until April 15th to mail it, I would definitely get a receipt.
Right. Right. Well, I live in an area where we're constantly having things disappear in the mail. So I just think you can't be too careful in terms of having the proof and having copies and keeping copies. So don't mail off your only copy.
That's right. Make sure that you keep a copy.
And you have good receipts. Okay, well, Patty, this has been very, very useful. Is there anything else in summary you'd like to add before we close?
Well, as you mentioned, it's probably a good idea to not try this at home. Do try to find a competent CPA to handle preparation of your taxes. The best way to find someone is to get a referral from a friend or relative that has used someone that they trust. If you don't have the opportunity to get a referral because you don't have friends or relatives using a CPA, you can always contact the state society of CPAs and get referrals from them. But definitely the complexity is great. Lots and lots of tax law changes. Do try to get someone to prepare your returns that knows what they're doing.
Right. Right. I couldn't agree more. Well, Patty, it's been a pleasure to have you on the Solari Report. We know you're going to have a busy between now. When is it? Between now and May is a very busy time.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is. So so thank you for joining us on the Solari Report. Have a wonderful day.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. You have a great day, too. Thank you.